Welcome to Political Rewind. For those of you who are listening to the podcast of this show, it might be Sunday, Tuesday, Thursday, who knows. But for those of us who are right now in the Political Rewind studio, it is Friday afternoon, and it couldn't have come sooner, Jim Galloway. It's been a long week.
Yeah, but if past Fridays are any guide, we're going to have breaking news as we're talking
here. Oh, bite your tongue. You just heard Jim Galloway. And by the way, you can download, subscribe to the Political Rewind podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. I don't say that nearly enough. Jim Galloway is with us, the political writer, the lead political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and the guy who oversees the political blog, which you can find on Politically Georgia every day.
$3.99 a month.
Okay. Give us your Friday preview of what your Sunday column is.
Sunday column is on politics, candidates, and sabotage childhoods. We've had three candidates, female candidates, this summer, this in the last few months running, who said they've got where they are despite their parents, not because of.
Oh, all right. We'll look forward to that in Sunday's paper. The panelist, the woman sitting right to your left who gave a quizzical look when you said what it was going to be, is our friend Loretta Lepore. She's a longtime Republican political consultant. She was Carly Fiorina's co-chair when Fiorina ran for president back in 2016. And she also does a lot of government affairs work, works on issues like transportation and other issues that matter to the state. Welcome, Loretta. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's nice to be here on a Friday afternoon, a busy Friday afternoon.
Yeah. Buddy Darden, former congressman, 7th District Democrat up in Cobb County. And as you were just pointing out to us, Buddy, that district went all the way from, what was the southern border when
from
you were
from the Chattahoochee
there?
River to the Chattanooga city limits.
Sounds like a song almost.
Absolutely.
And the west all the way to Alabama.
Absolutely. All up in the corner. But the great thing about politics is you couldn't make this stuff up. The things that we've been exposed to this past week.
Well, let's get right to it then. Thank you, buddy. We do want to give you some breaking news about 2 hours ago, really. A little more than that now. But the Trump administration, President Trump talked about this throughout his campaign. He said that he was going to address the Affordable Care Act's provision that women covered by employee health care plans would have that birth control measures, whether it was the pill or IUDs, other birth care, birth control devices, covered by their insurance. It's a statute that's been challenged in courts. Well, the president has now done what he said he was going to do, Jim. He has said that organizations that have a religious orientation that is contrary to birth control no longer have to provide
More than organizations, I think just any business that has religious scruples will be able to omit that from their insurance plans. And of course, that means that women are going to have to pay more. And one supposes that this is part of the transaction the deal that he cut with evangelical Christians back during the campaign to maintain their support.
You know, Loretta, HHS in drafting this new policy, and we won't go into it in detail today. There's so much to cover. Said that they believe that 99%, 99+% of women will still be able to get birth control covered by the Affordable Care Act. But that's being called into question by the critics because the administration really doesn't know under the new rules that they're setting what businesses, what organizations might in fact ask to be excused from providing birth control for religious reasons.
Right. So as Jim said, it's really any organization that could make a case as to why they no longer have to provide. You know, there has also been some discussion in the news today that funding will be made available to community resource centers or treatment centers, and that will be a way for women to get free contraception. which occurs now often. And we've seen in Georgia the expansion of these community centers across the state. Whether that money is made available in the budget is another consideration, and that's where we're going to start to see some of these legal challenges from opponents.
Yeah, there's definitely, I was going to turn to you on that, buddy. There's almost certain to be any number of lawsuits filed in opposition to this new ruling.
No question about it, because it is a cruel and impractical practice. And regrettably, the people that need it most will be the ones who are working with these organizations that probably have nothing to do with the management of it, but just third or fourth tier employees, and they're the ones that are going to have to bear the brunt of this.
All right, well, we'll follow that along, but the Trump administration, as Jim Galloway points out, has made good on a promise that did go to evangelical. But we should also point out, before we leave this, let's be careful, Jim, because one of the biggest opponents of this rule was not an evangelical church, it was the Catholic Church.
Catholic, but right. but what you have seen over the last 10, 15 years really is a merger of the agendas among Protestant conservative denominations like Southern Baptist and Catholic,
right. Okay.
Catholic organizations.
And it's not just the religious right. So if we could say conservatives in general would be supportive of eliminating a mandate, that government shouldn't be imposing these types of mandates on business, and then it should be up to business to decide whether or not they choose to offer this as a benefit to their employees, which in most cases, employers, if they're smart, are going to continue to afford their employees this benefit because it makes sense and they're going to recruit the best and the brightest.
Yeah.
So there's a whole logic to this in putting more competition, removing mandates, and, of course, making good on the promise to the conservative right.
Okay, let's move on. The big, big conversation in politics this week clearly comes out of the Las Vegas massacre on Sunday night. Excuse me. Guns and gun restrictions, gun safety, gun control, whatever words you want to use to describe it, and even the words, of course, are politicized, has become a very big topic of conversation in Washington and in states around the country. Jim, it was, you pointed out, it's been about a year since we had the mass shooting in Florida.
Right. A year and a few months, a couple months.
And at the club, nightclub.
Was it Pulse?
Pulse yes.
Nightclub in Orlando.
And shortly after that, John Lewis and a group of Democrats who were angry about the Republicans' lack of interest in pushing for gun restrictions went on the floor. They sat in on the floor of the House really a remarkable and dramatic gesture, which they got some heavy criticism
for. And sent it out on live stream against House rules.
Exactly. Well, in the aftermath of Las Vegas, John Lewis and a group primarily of Democrats are once again protesting the fact that Republicans don't seem to want to do anything about gun control measures. The other day, here's what John Lewis said in leading the charge.
How many more dead bodies will it take to wake up this Congress? But there's no number, is there? There's no amount of blood, of pain, of death, of suffering. What would move this Congress to act? We hold moments of silence and vigil. We offer our thoughts and prayers, but it's all a show, a placeholder. Don't tell me otherwise. I've been around too long. Don't tell me we need mental health reform when you won't provide every American access to mental health care. Don't tell me this is about protecting the Second Amendment when you won't stand up for the First Amendment.
John Lewis in a rally outside of the U.S. Capitol the other day. Buddy Darden, Republican leaders, Paul Ryan, others, are saying, yeah, maybe it is time to do something. And they have basically pointed to the so-called bump stock, the device that can be attached to a semi-automatic weapon to turn it into an automatic weapon. It's exactly what Stephen Paddock did with the guns that he took with him up into the hotel, his hotel suite.
I've been thinking a lot about this, Bill, and frankly speaking, I think this is nothing except a poor Band-Aid. It's not even a good Band-Aid, and it's purely used just as a ploy to try to take the real heat off of the aggressive gun groups. And in my view, so what if it does pass? It won't make a single bit of difference. This is the same crowd who also want to enact a provision to make silencers legal. So I've got some thoughts on this we'll discuss later
on. But let's be careful about that. You're certainly right that Republicans appeared to be on the way to passing a bill that would make silencers legal. But the Speaker did, in fact, pull that bill, which was supposed to be, by a coincidence of timing, on the floor this week. He has now said he's pulled it indefinitely. So we should be clear about that, right?
That's correct. And if nothing else good comes out of this, at least the silencer legislation perhaps will go away.
There are two aspects to what happened on Sunday night that are kind of reverberating. Number one, of course, it's just the sound of the automatic weapon. I mean, it's just that is just frightening. It beyond words, and the fact that you can buy a gizmo and convert your single shot rifle to something that shoots nine times every second is right. We have federal restrictions on machine guns. This is a workaround.
Since 1934.
There is a gizmo there's another thing, not a stock bump, a bump stock, but a trigger crank that I can order from Bass Pro Shop and have in my house on my gun in 24 hours. And it will fire, maybe four or five shots every second. So that's one thing. The other thing is simply that's really more frightening is the lack of motive. There has been no hint at why this guy did what he did, except the fact that he obviously was planning it for years, possibly. And it cuts to the core of the Republican argument that the only thing to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun, because this guy was a good guy until his finger pulled the trigger.
Loretta?
Well, I think this really stopped a lot of people in their tracks. And I think for the first time in a very long time, we're hearing Republicans up on the Hill even acknowledging that something needs to be done. With regard to this bump stock, many of them are admitting they didn't even know what it was until this incident occurred.
Did any of us really know what it was? I certainly didn't.
I did not. And the level of sophistication and the amount of ammunition stockpiled around this, and just all of the technology and the guns and it was just an unbelievable event that I think that some people are still reeling from it and trying to comprehend everything, and the fact that we don't, to Jim's point, have a lot of answers. But I think in terms of the legislation, we're seeing some concessions by way of regulation, right? So the Bureau of Alcohol,
right.
Tobacco, and Firearms, twice under the Obama administration, renewed, allowed them to be sold. And I think we're seeing some perhaps concessions in that regard. The NRA is saying, okay, you can do it by regulation, and then they've got their terms by which you can do that, which is probably not going to fly very well. And then you've got to see where the president is and if he's willing to open that debate to at least by rule or regulation prohibiting the sale of these items.
Which of course would allow all Republican members of Congress to avoid a recorded vote.
It's not just the recorded vote. I'm sorry to interrupt, not just the recorded vote they're worried about. I mean, Senator Grassley, he was very clear. One of the concerns he has is that if a bill makes it to the floor, then it becomes a Christmas tree. And you've got Democrats and Republicans loading it up with amendments.
And it becomes
a whole big thing that none of them want to get into.
And Bill, here's the other part of that is, okay, the NRA said it's willing to see movement on stock bumps, or bump stocks, whatever. but Steve Bannon, the Trump's former White House strategist, is saying, don't you dare. Yeah. He is drawing a line even there. You dare not do that, Mr. Trump.
You know what? I thought you hit on something, Loretta, that's really important as part of this, buddy. NRA got some fairly good headlines the first day that it became clear they might be supportive of doing something about these devices. But at first, it sounded as if what they were talking about doing was supporting legislation to make them illegal. But as Loretta points out, no way. They want ATF to take this under their jurisdiction because, as she points out, no Republican wants to see a bill come to the floor that could become a vehicle for much more strict, much more severe potential restrictions.
Well, BATF has become a toothless tiger over the years because the Congress has refused to give it adequate funding to really even carry out its mission. I remember historically Randolph Thrower, who was IRS commissioner when BATF was under IRS, ended up leaving the Nixon administration because he opposed the appointment of G. Gordon Liddy to be head of BATF. And it was eventually separated out from IRS because they felt like that there were too many Republican liberals who were trying to enforce the gun laws strictly. So we'll talk about more details later on, but in any event, I think the Congress ought to go ahead if they believe a change ought to be made, ought to have the guts to stand up and say, let's do it.
Buddy, you took your seat in the United States House in 1984, and you come from a county that was, I would assume, relatively pro-gun, a lot of gun owners in Cobb County. What's the history? What do you recall about how, over the years, Georgia voters, what did they tell you about gun laws in Congress, and how did the NRA talk to you back in those days about your support for their agenda?
Well, let's go back to the time that the city of Kennesaw passed an ordinance at one time requiring that everybody have a firearm.
With an asterisk that they, said
with an asterisk, Jim, go ahead and tell them what it was.
That is, you have to buy you have to have a gun if you're that of a household unless you don't want to.
And of course, the city of Acworth countered by requiring everybody up on Lake Allatoona in the city of Acworth to have a fishing pole. But in any event, this has changed so much since I came into public life. And generally speaking, when I came into public life, the gun lobby and the people supporting gun rights were generally on the defensive. They were mainly trying to keep people from going further and incurring further restrictions against firearms. And when I was in the state legislature, for example, we all agreed in the beginning of the session that we wouldn't change and try to change the gun laws in Georgia and would allow them to stay as they are. Over the years, historically, though, and by the time I've been reflecting on this a little bit in the last few minutes, it seems to me that instead of being on the defense, now the gun rights people have gone on the offense. And every time it seems like that there's an accord or there's an agreement about something, then of course, the NRA and the gun rights people keep moving the ball further and further.
I want to continue this conversation. And, Jim, I want to bring it back to the state of even more to the state of Georgia and how it's going to play into the gubernatorial race. But let's take a break before I do that. And as we go to a break, Tom Faust, our producer, pulled some really interesting figures for us. It turns out that a quarter of Americans own all the guns in this country, just 25% own all of the guns. And what's really interesting is that half of all the guns in the country are possessed by only 3% of American adults. So while there are hundreds of millions of guns in circulation, ownership is not as broad as we might have thought it was. I just thought that was an interesting thing.
There are hundreds of thousands of basement arsenals out there.
Yeah. All right. We're going to come back and talk a little bit about how guns will play in state races in 2018. You're listening to Political Rewind.
Wherever news is happening, GPB takes you there, from here in Georgia to the other side of the world. As Hurricane Irma moved into our state, we suspended our fall fund drive in order to provide you with the latest from GPB reporters across Georgia and GEMA to help keep you and your family safe. The campaign resumes on October 12th, but don't wait. Your support now is a direct investment in the coverage you rely on day after day. Please go to gpb.org and click donate, and thanks.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Jim Galloway, Loretta Lepore, Buddy Darden in the studio. Before we talk about guns in the state, Buddy, I cut you a little short there at the end. You wanted to add something to your comments about guns?
Yes, I've been reviewing this situation at least for the last 20 years. And, of course, the rights of gun owners have dramatically been expanded with Supreme Court decisions, with legislation both at the federal and at the state level. And while the Second Amendment is supposed to keep us safe and from being shot and protected, at the same time, the level of gun violence, as we've gotten more gun rights, has escalated greatly, exponentially. And so the Second Amendment, which is supposed to be protecting us, seems to be in a situation where it's getting most of us killed.
Just to put a coat on that, and Olivia Rheingold, maybe we can add this to our blog today when we post the show. I would really, we're not going to get into it here, I would really encourage people. We'll put a link up to Brett Stevens' column in the New York Times. Brett Stevens is a conservative. He is not someone who has been a big supporter of gun restrictions. He had a column in the Times the other day titled Repeal the Second Amendment. And it is a great argument, not about restricting guns, but by pointing out that conservatives have misinterpreted the Second Amendment for many years, and therefore their arguments about guns are fallacious. If you didn't have that language in the Second Amendment, you could look at guns more realistically. Yes, Jim, isn't that basically what he argues?
Yeah. I think so. I think it's interesting. The Second Amendment is one of those few parts of the according to current conservative interpretation, where it takes a very optimistic view of human behavior.
Okay. All right. Let's move on to the state, if we can, real quickly. The Democratic candidates for governor, Stacey Abrams and Stacey Evans, debated the other night. And because, of course, it was right in the aftermath of Las Vegas, they were asked about what they supported in terms of gun restrictions. Here's just a couple of brief comments from them.
There have been too many acts of political cowardice in the wake of gun violence.
And we need to make sure that we are taking action to have good, common sense gun laws.
So that was both Abrams. First it was Abrams and then Evans. Jim, is any candidate, Democrat or Republican in this state for governor, going to want to go too far in promoting restrictions on gun ownership?
We're going to find out, aren't we?
Well, what do you think?
I think that this is going to become an issue on the Democratic side of the coin, and I think Stacey Abrams is going to try to push as hard as she can on gun restrictions. And I think on Monday we heard Stacey Evans do the same, but in a more structured manner in terms of repealing specific pieces of legislation.
Loretta, you might be able to win a primary with that line of thought, but I don't know about becoming a governor of Georgia if that's where you go.
Right. That's what I was, as Jim was talking, that's what I was thinking, that, you know, I think Stacey Abrams, if she is going to be ideologically true to herself, is going to push on this issue. And it will be a big campaign issue for her. I think for Stacey Abrams, in her comments, if, you know, just listening to them, not seeing her, but listening to them, it seems that she's sort of positioning a little bit more for a statewide audience in her commentary. I mean, common sense, when you use the term common sense, I always think that's in the eye of the beholder, right? What is mm-hmm. common sense? So she nuanced her response.
Yes, Stacey Evans, by the way.
Stacey Evans, yeah, I'm sorry. Stacey Evans, yes.
Do you want to finish? Did I interrupt
you? No.
Okay. So, Buddy, Jim Galloway had a really interesting column that I dragged up from quite some time ago about Jason Carter. In 2014, when Carter was the Democratic candidate for governor, he was one of only four Democrats in the legislature, in the state Senate, to vote in favor of became called Guns Everywhere legislation that Governor Deal eventually signed. And boy, he got called out for that. He was, Jim points out that he went on MSNBC and Chuck Todd really went after him, drilled down on that. He thought he was making a broader appeal by supporting making guns more readily available.
Well, Bill, you have unintentionally given me an opportunity to try to make a point that I've been trying to make for the last 5 minutes, and that is, if their sole issue, if the only issue they care about, and if they're going to select their governor solely on the basis of that person's position on firearms legislation, then the Democrats aren't going to get those people anyway. However, what we're going to try to do is appeal to the moderate voter, like myself, who owns guns, who hunts, who can shoot, at the same time doesn't think that everybody ought to be able to have a bazooka in their basement. And that's the issue here, I think.
Well, I think there's a couple of things. First, I think on the Republican side, you're going to have a little bit of a different conversation. And I think what will be interested on the Republican side of the House is that you're going to have two candidates in this race that have military experience. And they're going to draw from experience and have a little bit different perspective.
The two who have the experience are
Hunter Hill,
right,
who currently is former now
right,
state senator from the 6th District representing Marietta and Buckhead, and Clay Tippins,
thanks,
who is coming from the private sector, the nephew of Senator Lindsey Tippins, who's a former Navy SEAL. And so both of these gentlemen have seen combat. Both of them are very familiar with weaponry, and weaponry like we've seen in this incident in Las Vegas that is not common to most of us. And so I think it will be interesting to hear their perspectives on the campaign trail, too, about this. I think one of the interesting points that John Lewis raised, and I think one thing at the state and the federal level that has not had any attention to date is this focus on mental health. And I mean, when we're looking at these incidents, everybody that has committed, each of the folks that have recently in recent times has committed one of these acts of atrocity has had an issue, a mental health issue, a diagnosed mental health issue. And most of them are men or young men in particular. This gentleman, Stephen Paddock, was uncharacteristic by FBI profilers in terms of the type of person that would commit this type of act. But if we look at all of the other incidents recently in Colorado and Sandy Hook, et cetera, Orlando, these are young men. And we are not addressing part of that issue around mental health, which is it is so complicated, complex. But everybody that has committed one of these acts, and you will hear gun advocates say it's not the gun, it's the person behind the gun.
Jim?
Yeah, but at some point, I think we have to address just the technological issue, the amount of damage that can be done in such a short space of time. And this gets at the question of clip capacity. It gets at these little gadgets that help you shoot faster, even if it's more inaccurate, because God knows, machine guns aren't necessarily a defensive weapon. Those are offensive weapons.
Well, I would agree with you on that, and I would say that the NRA, you know, going back to our conversation about the NRA and Bill's question asking Buddy about what type of influence did they have when he was in Congress, you know, they are very active at state level races also, you know, state reps, state house, Senate, gubernatorial races. And that is one of the questions that they ask and that they want you to respond to as a candidate is about these clips,
yeah,
you know, and they want you to be wholeheartedly endorsing of zero restriction at any time in order to get a rating.
As I was trying to say a while ago, too, is the NRA keeps on moving the ball. It used to be that they would go along with reasonable waiting periods and certain restrictions on assault weapons, but as the public mind changes and as the gun business and the gun lobby and the gun sellers get more and more active, and they control the NRA these days. Everybody knows that. It's a business deal. It's money. It's about trying to get more and more people to buy guns. But the interesting thing about it is now that the bogeyman, Obama's not around anymore, gun sales are actually down. So they've got to figure some way now to gin up the public again. But I want to make one point about our friends. This is of a legal nature. bill, the so-called originalists who believe that the Constitution ought to be based on how things were at the time the Constitution was enacted. When the Constitution was enacted, and they talked about the present Second Amendment, we had nothing but muskets at the time and gunpowder loaded guns. I don't think the founders of the Constitution ever anticipated the technology now associated with these weapons now.
All right. The another figure that Tom Faust pulled out for us, during his campaign for president, Donald Trump got $30.3 million from the NRA. And during the 2016 election cycle, the NRA donated $20 million to people who were running for
Congress. And if you'll remember, one of Trump's first appearance in Atlanta was before the giant NRA convention, and that has been his strongest institutional supporter, I think.
Absolutely, that's right.
To be fair, he didn't have many institutional supporters, and so.
Well, thank goodness then that the NRA was there.
No. But I'm saying that the NRA did come in, and they actually gave more because they wanted him to be the president, right?
Yeah.
And so they did not want Hillary Clinton. That was not going to advance their cause, and so they filled a vacuum, a void that would, perhaps jeopardized his candidacy.
Okay.
So.
The NRA has become, at one time, a good source of information and a good source of how gun safety ought to be carried on so forth and what Congress ought to do. And now, to the present day, political thugs that they've become.
Okay. Buddy Darden gets that last word in this part of the conversation. before we take a break, Jim, Politico had an interesting story. We've talked on this show a number of times about the fact that Nick Ayers, when we all here in Georgia, a Georgia guy, we first got to know him when he was working for Sonny Perdue's campaign for governor. He went into the Perdue administration, had a meteoric rise, became the head of the Republican Governors Association in Washington. He couldn't have been. He had to be in his early 20s at that point.
Mid-20s. Yeah.
All right. And now he is Vice President Mike Pence's chief of staff after being considered pretty seriously to be chairman of the Republican National Committee. All that said, Jim, reports in Politico indicate that Nick Ayers is trying to get big money donors to form a coalition to take on GOP leaders and members who don't back the president, and Politico likes to describe it as a purge.
Well, I think that's the word that Nick used, and
it was in a
recorded address that he gave. The recording was surreptitious and leaked to Politico.
Okay, but what's odd about this, Loretta, is I would understand if Nick was working for Steve Bannon at Breitbart, but he's the vice president's chief of staff.
Right, and I did listen to the tape as well, and he did qualify that when he made those remarks, he was asked, it was in a question and answer section of the conversation, and somebody had asked him the question about, what should we be doing, and he said, I'm not speaking on behalf of the president or the vice president, and in my capacity, I'm not supposed to be, I can't give political advice. However, this purging idea is what he came forward with.
Okay, I get that he was not taking.
And remember, Bill, that he was part of the group that put out those TV ads against the Nevada senator.
Yeah.
When he came out against the health care bill.
Yeah, against Dean Heller. Okay, Buddy, you want to jump in?
Who can be more establishment Republican than our friend Nick Ayers? And I've never seen such a turn in all my life. He just bought a mansion up on Habersham Way right in the middle of the Republican Buckhead, and now he's acting like he doesn't even know who these people are. He's going to take them out.
Well, I want to make something, because Loretta, I want to go back to your point. Of course, we don't have any reason to believe Nick Ayers is acting on behalf of the vice president, which is why I think it's so interesting. Pence has tied himself at the hip to Trump, and so for his chief of staff perhaps to be suggesting that there ought to be a purge, I get that it's to Trump's advantage, but in the long run, it also seems to me that it opens the door for some of these wild right-wingers to come into Congress you can't control at all, who wouldn't necessarily be pro-Trump. That was my point.
Well, right. That is always a danger. But he did qualify by saying, you know, I mean, he did reference his experience with the Republican Governors Association, and he does come from a political background, not a governing background, so it's instinctive to him. But you do have that choice. But I think his point to them, if I was to remember correctly his comments, it was, we will pick those candidates and stage those candidates.
Fair enough. Thank you.
And you also have to remember that this was said in the aftermath of Roy Moore's victory in Alabama. And that's what has your establishment Republicans quite frightened.
Right.
Well, and he was speaking to the choir in this meeting, because you had a lot of high wealth donors in this room. The meeting was convened by the RNC, and these folks are very disenchanted with the way things are going on in Washington. And some of these donors, we saw another meeting this week out in Colorado, California, simultaneously, where you had high wealth donors saying, I'm not giving anymore. Don't bother calling me until you actually do something. Pass tax reform, pass health care, and then you can call me, but don't call me until that happens. And that's on a voluntary basis. Nobody had to encourage that.
Buddy, as a former member, can now laugh as he's doing right now at the dysfunction.
I can't understand what these people want. I mean, Republicans now control the Senate, they control the House, they control the White House, they control the Supreme Court. So what's left for them to do?
Buddy, I am so glad you mentioned that, because it tees up what I'd love to talk about for a few minutes. All of this leads to the 2018 election cycle and how Donald Trump is going to be have an impact on that, how Mitch McConnell's role is going to be a part of that, how Nancy Pelosi, whose leadership all of a sudden this week was being questioned. Not that it hasn't before, but we'll talk about that.
Oh, but we need her to stay there.
Okay, we meaning Republicans.
I guess. We'd like Nancy right where she is.
So Marsha Blackburn, a conservative Republican in the Tennessee delegation, announced just this week that she is going to seek the U.S. Senate seat that's being given up by Bob Corker, who's decided to retire. Here's a TV ad that Marsha Blackburn has just put up. Listen carefully to how she is going to focus her campaign.
The fact that our Republican majority in the U.S. Senate can't overturn Obamacare or will not overturn Obamacare, it's a disgrace. Too many Senate Republicans act like Democrats or worse, and that's what we have to change.
Oh, buddy, you talk about chaos.
Well, Bob Corker, whom she seeks to replace, voted the right way. And so far as Republicans are concerned, I don't see her point unless she's trying to go after John McCain. Maybe she ought to move to Arizona, run against him.
Lamar Alexander voted with the majority. So he's the other senator from Tennessee.
Well, I think her point is fairly clear, Jim. And maybe I'm not thinking this through enough. She's suggesting that she's the one who's going to go up there to fight all of those swamp-like Republicans who are not getting anything done.
What she's really saying, this is code, and she is saying, I would be among those in favor of getting rid of Mitch McConnell.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think that's exactly right. Now, simultaneous to that, the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, has a cable ad running in which they are laying the groundwork for what they think is going to be the argument that Democratic congressional candidates across the country can make.
They'll never stop. Paul Ryan and Washington's establishment Republicans, catering to drug companies and special interests, coming after your health care, increasing your out-of-pocket costs, a devastating age tax if you're 50 or older, ending guaranteed coverage for pre-existing conditions. Paul Ryan and the Washington Republicans. It's the same thing every time. The rest of us have to change Washington.
All right, so Democrats are going to run against Paul Ryan.
Paul Ryan.
The Republicans like Blackburn are going to run against Mitch McConnell.
and Trump gets a pass on both sides.
That's really what a great comment. Neither of those ads reference Donald Trump at all. Interesting.
Well, it's somewhat ironic that they're accusing Paul Ryan of raising the cost of health care. given, I mean, really, if you're going to make the case that Republicans haven't done anything on one side of the coin, then how could they be responsible for raising the cost of health care? That was a Democratic maneuver.
To me, buddy, all of this says that the next year of Political Rewind is going to have a lot of really good stuff to talk about.
It's going to be rough and tumble, and it's going to be mean. In the meantime, there is a public interest that I really think most people in Congress are concerned about. And there lies the real problem right here is how do you do these things and accomplish these things without throwing out the baby with the bathwater. This is a great country. We've got a lot of good things going, and not everybody in Washington is an incompetent fool. In fact, most of them are really conscientious people trying to do the right thing. You only hear from, of course, the people like Tim Murphy, who came into such prominence this week.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll say, you know, as a Republican, I listened this morning to Senator Klobuchar.
Amy Klobuchar.
Yeah, her. I didn't want to butcher her name, but she was incredibly articulate talking on one of the talk shows this morning. But the whole genesis of her commentary was about how she was working across the aisle with various senators to get legislation passed. And the legislation was moving through the chamber, whether it was Lindsey Graham or I forget which other senator she mentioned. But there are people up there that are doing work. It may not be on these big monster bills, which should maybe tell us something, but are doing yeoman's work. And I would say that we need more consensus builders.
Right,
we need fewer on the fringes and more willing to work across the party lines to get things done.
We got to get another break in. Amy Klobuchar, by the way, has been a guest on this show. She is smart, articulate, and even better, got a great sense of humor, which doesn't hurt a politician. Let's take our final break of the show and come back. We got a lot more to talk about in the last few minutes of today.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Georgia Public Broadcasting. We're an 18-station radio network of GPB. I'm Ellen Reinhart. GPB Atlanta is licensed to Georgia State University, ranked among the top universities in the nation in commitment to undergraduate teaching.
After Hurricane Harvey hit Houston, donations streamed in, but too often, the stuff is useless.
The thing on your mind is removing the mold from your house. You can't repair your house with a bottle of water.
So one small aid organization takes cash donations and then distributes that cash to those in need. The Give Directly model at work in Texas this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered is this afternoon from 4 till 7 on GPB.
You know, Jim, as we move on, I think Loretta just made an interesting point about Amy Klobuchar. We've heard the two ads that really demonize, one of them demonizes her own party. Wouldn't it be fascinating if somebody runs a campaign and can prove to be successful by talking about working across the aisle? What a laboratory experiment that would be in these divisive times.
Yeah.
Well, and to have proof points.
Yeah.
Can you get that done? I am more and more pessimistic.
Buddy?
Well, Johnny Isaacson, prior to his going to the United States Senate, even prior to his going to the United States House of Representatives, when he was in the minority, he really made a career of working across the aisle. He was chairman of the State Board of Education, appointed by Zell Miller. He was able to get legislation through, and haven't followed all the things he's done, but a lot of people like Johnny Isaacson who really have good instincts and would like to be able to make a better place of the United States Congress.
Paul Coverdale was another example
The situation is such that, yes, you can do that, buddy. You just can't run on it.
All right. It is it's late on a Friday afternoon. Again, if you're listening to the podcast, it's whatever time it is. But here in the studio, it's almost 4 o'clock. Jim Galloway, we all know what happens on Friday afternoons. A week ago today, we were sitting in here saying, it doesn't look so good for Tom Price. Now the question is, what do we think could happen today?
Secretary of State and spokesmodel of Just for Eyebrows, Rex Tillerson, openly disparaged Trump by referring to him as a moron after meeting at the Pentagon. Hold on there, Rex. Hold on there, Tillerson. Nobody calls our president a moron except me.
Stephen Colbert. Sarah Huckabee Sanders was asked today by a reporter, today is Friday, could we expect a resignation today? And she apparently answered, I don't think so.
That supposedly caused an eruption in the White House on Wednesday morning when that broke. And what you've seen is a very interesting circling of the wagons of John Kelly, Rex Tillerson, and Mattis over on defense. And there was this great observation from Bob Corker, the Tennessee senator, who said, this is the trio that is holding our country together and preventing chaos from taking over. Now, where was that chaos coming from?
Now, you don't want to hear this, Bill, but I heard this wonderful interview with George Shultz, Ronald Reagan's Secretary of State, in which he stated that he and Ronald Reagan got together almost every day, if not two or three times a week, to coordinate everything that was said by Ronald Reagan in the area of international affairs, and that while they might have disagreed occasionally on the direction to take, Ronald Reagan was the president and he followed orders. But at the same time, they worked together and worked in harmony, and they were never out of sync.
All right. I know I'm going to get some people out there irritated, and that's okay. Loretta, you're a former CNN journalist. Mm-hmm. So I want to pick your brain on it and then ask Jim, too. The NBC reporting this week, Carol Lee and Andrea Mitchell did it together, about Tillerson being on the verge of quitting last summer, being talked out of it by Mike Pence. And then, of course, we learned from that reporting that he called Trump a moron, which he denies he did. I have to be honest, as a journalist myself, that I'm not clear on what a story that took place in July, what the import of it is, except to the extent that it advances a journalistic argument about the chaos in the White House. If it had just happened that week, and if Tillerson was on the bubble, I get it. But this is 4 months later, and I'm just wondering if... Isn't this why? I don't think that NBC had an agenda, but I can understand why conservatives think they have an agenda when they report a story like this.
Well, absolutely. And I do think that, you know, if anyone that was to watch MSNBC these days would know that some of their programs clearly have an agenda, and it's an anti-Trump agenda. I think your point also goes to Secretary Tillerson's comments about when he came out to address this confidence level between he and the president, when he said to the reporter, I just don't get Washington this way. No. You know, this is how many months ago, you know, that you're asking me about. But his point was, I just don't get Washington. This is nitty gritty stuff. This is not what it's like where we do business, where I come from. And so I think there is validity to that. And I think there is validity today that there is far too much reporting going on that is unsubstantiated and is just according to sources. And we're
Well, you're not denying the importance of anonymous sources.
No, I'm not. I'm not denying anonymous sources. But we keep getting this daily, like, oh, this source told me this, and this source told me that. And I think it's a journalist's obligation to vet those sources,
right?
And to say, does the source have an angle? Does the source coming with a point of view? Is the source have an agenda that they're trying to accomplish? And I think that that's where there's been a problem with
reporting. Let me get you both in.
Okay, I think I need to push back on this just a little bit.
Of course
bit. And even your skepticism of the moron comment here. This grows out of a situation in which Rex Tillerson, who's supposed to be in charge of foreign policy for the United States government, said quite clearly that the U.S. is in direct conversation with North Korea on several avenues. Immediately after that hit the newspapers, we had a tweet from the President of the United States saying, Rex, give that up. Yeah. It's not worth talking to them. That was a direct contradiction of his chief policy officer, and that is, I mean, in the real world, that matters. You have to start looking at that relationship in a serious manner.
All right, I think.
No, I'm not denying that you have to look at it in a serious manner. I
have to say I understand what Galloway is saying, and he makes the best argument for why that story does matter.
And here's why it's important. What about the uncontradicted story when President Trump berated his attorney general in front of several people. It shows how he has no use or regard for anyone else who might have superior knowledge or understanding about anything except for himself. And it shows that he's off on this total ego trip, thinking he knows more about state than the Secretary of State, more about justice than the Attorney General, more about Health and Human Services than Tom Price, and so forth and so on. So I think it's highly relevant to what's going on in this country today, and I think the press is doing a great job in reporting.
Okay. Look, I think that is a valid point, that the journalists do have an obligation to make sure that U.S. policy is consistent and that anybody representing this country is consistent with what the objectives are as set out by the White House. But I don't think it's okay for reporters to what Bill was referencing was to focus on the minutia, nitty-gritty, sourcing people. We're talking two different planes of reporting here and two different issues. And this is not the first time that a president and an emissary have not been on the same page. I mean, this happened before, where Henry Kissinger sent George Bush over to China to have a conversation while Henry Kissinger was having conversations with somebody else on a totally different level. And it was intentional. It was intentional that they weren't on the same page. This is not the first time that this has happened. It's just, how are we reporting what's going on? I think there's valid questions about that. And I think that's where you're going with the...
Yeah, I love hearing it, both of your arguments, all three of your arguments about this. And I said this on Wednesday show, I'll say it again now. Anytime you have essentially somebody saying, I did not call the president of the United States a moron, it's like Richard Nixon saying, I am not a crook. It's unfortunately gets into the political bloodstream. Jim Galloway? Hope you have a good weekend. You're back here Monday with me when we have Michael Thurman, one of the most successful Democratic political leaders in the state and beyond just politics, will be here. He's now CEO of DeKalb County. He'll be here with former state rep Ed Lindsay, Republican, who is a guy with a lot of great stories to tell and a lot of opinions about what's happening in the news today. We'll see both of them Monday at 2. Loretta Lepore, thank you so much for being with us. Buddy Darden, Todd Ream just tweeted, Uncle Buddy, because he insists that should be your new nickname, is at his best today. You've won the Todd Ream stamp of approval for the day. And Todd Ream, we hope that your ALS walk tomorrow is an enormous success. We'll be thinking about you and your wife, Stephanie, throughout the day. I'm Bill Nigut. Thanks to Tom Faust, to Olivia Rheingold. And we are so special because we have our operations manager. We have a boss running our board today, Tom Barclay. Thank you for that, Tom. We appreciate your filling in this week while Tyler Morris was on vacation. We'll see you again Monday at 2. Thanks for being with us. Have a great weekend.